I was driving from the Lady Bower Reservoir, just up the A57 in Sheffield. I didn't really see this left-hand corner that was coming up.
What did you hit?
I think what happened, because of the speed I was going around the left-hand corner, I ended up rolling the car, and I destroyed somebody's very nice stone wall. Sorry about that.
How was it that you lost your arm?
The seatbelt apparently wasn't clipped in properly, and it was the seatbelt that actually came across my chest and actually severed my arm.
So were you thrown out of the car?
Yeah, I left the car and landed in a field, and I think my arm was left in the car.
So you don't remember this? You were in too much shock.
No, I was in way too much shock. I didn't know anything about it. Apparently, I was conscious for the whole thing, which is the thing that actually saved me.
Why was that?
Because my body went into shock, and I didn't really bleed, so that actually stopped me from bleeding to death.
And how did you get to the hospital?
Well, fortunately, there was this midwife that lived very close to where the accident actually happened.
Gosh.
And she was obviously experienced enough, you know, in medical terms. And I think she packed my arm in ice because she was preparing for, you know, for New Year's sort of celebrations. Unfortunately, I messed up a few people's New Year. But as I say, I didn't know anything about it, so I was in a world of my own at the time.
So when you came to in the ward, mm-hmm. did you know you'd lost your arm?
No, I didn't, because there were so many bandages, and my mind and my body kind of let me in on this whole thing very gradually. It wasn't something that just hit me, you know, oh, my arm's gone. It was over a 2 or 3 week period that you know, that I actually realized that the entire thing had gone.
And I want, and I need, and I love.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and this is episode number 4 about Def Leppard. We're going to focus on Hysteria for this episode, and joining me is Joey Haney from the Rock Strikes 10 podcast. Hey, Joey.
Hello, BJ. Thanks for having me on. It's an honor to be on your wonderful show.
Thank you for coming on. I think we're going to have some disagreements, maybe, about the quality of this record, I'm guessing.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, because I've listened to like every episode of your show, and I don't think you've ever said anything disparaging about Hysteria. But so now I'm kind of curious. Yeah, if we're gonna fight, that's gonna be fun anyway. Because you know we could walk out of it friends, and I'll still respect you.
I've done 3 episodes already. Hopefully, the audience is still with me on this Def Leppard thing. Always been one of my favorite bands, and I'm definitely gonna do more of these series in the future. Because it's been really fun. Hopefully the listeners are also enjoying it. But just going album by album and just kind of dissecting the career is a pretty fun thing to do. And I really love the idea of having different guests on for each record. So again, thanks a lot for doing this. And so yeah, we're here to talk about Hysteria. it's crazy. This record came out, what is it, 4 years and 8 months after Pyromania. So that is a long, that's a long time to take to follow up one of the biggest records of all time.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and when the music business was a true business and thriving, that was a story unto itself. So the album was a legend before it even came out, much like, you know, Don't Look Back, you know.
Yeah, or Chinese Democracy. This is kind of like the early early version of, you know, what happened with, of course, Chinese Democracy was a much longer and much more ridiculous saga, but... you know, the thing is, they started right after they came off the Pyromania tour. They started working on their next record, you know, and they went through a whole list of producers they tried to get. I talked with Greg Renoff at the end of the Pyromania episode about how one of the first people they approached was Ted Templeman. So, of course, I had to bring that up to Greg because he's the Van Halen rising guy.
Sure, and, yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, they were pretty close to working with Ted, except there was a money dispute. Joe Elliott said Ted Templeman wanted too much money. But, you know, this is right after Van Halen 1984, so you can see why they had Ted Templeman in mind. And sure. They also they went to Mike Stone, Phil Collins, Trevor Horn, and Chris Thomas, and just none of those people were able to do it. I guess Chris Thomas just turned them down flat. Yeah.
Trevor Horn would have been interesting. I mean... I don't know what that would have sounded like, but that was the name that kind of that kind of popped me the most, that name, for some reason, just because of, you know, what that would have been. Ted Tillman, I'm curious, like, wasn't he like a contract Warner guy? Could you actually go out and take a gig besides what you normally do, you know?
I don't know. Thinking
about with Ted.
I don't know. Maybe after 1984. I mean, he must have had a lot of clout in the industry. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, you're right, though. Then he became an A&R guy and everything, so...
Yeah, and according to David Lee Roth, he still makes more money on the records than he does.
Yeah, Trevor Horn... See, Def Leppard became tax exiles after Pyromania, and they moved to Ireland, and Trevor Horn said he would do it if they did it in England, and they didn't want to do it in England.
Oh, man.
So and Chris Thomas just said no, and he... I mean, Chris Thomas had produced Roxy Music. He's the guy who produced Nevermind the Bollocks, but he would then do In Excess, like have huge... hits with In Excess. He did a ton of stuff, but that's another strange guy to think about. I mean, he had there's a lot of variety in the stuff he produced, but...
I bet Joe would have preferred him over anybody else besides Mudd, of course. If it had to be anybody besides Mudd, I'm sure that would have been the guy he would have liked the most.
Yeah, that's the... they wanted Mutt Lange the whole time, but they wanted to get to work on the record, and Mutt wasn't available. I've read two different stories. Either he wasn't available, or he was just too burned out after Pyromania and wasn't in the mood.
Or like, a combination, maybe. What was he maybe. Working on?
Yeah, what did he... He produced... What did he do around then? Heartbeat City? Heartbeat City maybe was around then?
83. I mean, he must have been working on it during 83 because either it got released in 84 or it came out right at the beginning of 84. So it must have just been 8. So he was...
Yeah, I'm not sure what he was doing then.
Yeah.
I should have looked that up. But So they wanted Mudd all along, but they end up with Jim Steinman, and that did not go well. Jim Steinman basically said that he refused to quit because he wouldn't have gotten paid. So it was the kind of thing where he just waited him out.
Yeah.
It reminded me, I don't know if people are watching Better Call Saul, but that was something that happened on Better Call Saul where Bob Odenkirk was working for a law firm and he didn't want to quit because he would lose his bonus. So he just had to wait until they fired him. And that's what Jim Steinman did. He sat it out. But, you know, Jim Steinman didn't do the kind of obsessive tinkering and just have so much input the way Mutt Lange became like another band member, I guess. And I guess that's what they wanted. And Jim Steinman wasn't doing that. And I saw a quote from Joe Elliott where he's like, you know, Jim Steinman wrote Bad Out of Hell, but he didn't produce it. Todd Rundgren did, you know? And so,
Yeah. I watched the Classic Albums documentary on this again, kind of, you know, boning up for the show, of course. And they were pretty disparaging to him in a sense. You know, he gave him the credit for writing Bad Hell, like you said. But I don't know if they're just exaggerating, but they made it seem like we were just tuning up for a take. And he was like, okay, that's good. You're done. That's a take.
And, you know, I mean, the impression I get of Jim Steinman is he's kind of a weirdo. and, you know, probably a certain kind of personality that it takes a certain kind of person to mesh with, I would guess. Which I guess Mutt Lang's probably the same way, but they obviously meshed with him. Of course, the, you know, the major event that occurs when they're trying to make this album is New Year's Eve 1984 into 1985, when Rick Allen loses control of his Corvette while passing another car, hits a stone wall, flips repeatedly, ending up in a field, and he was thrown from the car, but his arm stayed in the car. And apparently his seatbelt was incorrectly fastened somehow, because his girlfriend was in the passenger seat, and she was not really injured at all in this same crash where he loses his arm. So I guess her seatbelt was correctly fastened and his wasn't. I don't know.
Yeah, which is like a miracle. Like, and apparently that was a road rage incident too. It's one of those things where he was trying to pass somebody on a two-way.
Yeah, he was annoyed they were going too slow, and he was really he probably floored it. You know, the kind of thing where you're sending a message by how loud you're speeding past them. Yeah. And so then, you know, I've said this before on the show, I believe, when I was talking to the Shabby Road guys on our Sophomore Slump episode. I said this, but I am of the unpopular opinion that if you're a rock band and your drummer loses his arm, that's tragic, but the harsh reality is you need a new drummer, because, in my opinion, you cannot play the drums properly in a rock and roll band with one arm. That's just my opinion. So I understand the friendship, the band, you know, I understand everything they were going through. You know, what happened to this guy, and then he's going to also lose. I mean, he's never done anything else in his life. He joined Def Leppard when he was 15 or something.
Yeah, as they all did, pretty much. 14, 15, yeah.
But, the big but is, you can't play drums in a rock band with one arm. You can trigger electronic bullshit with your foot, but you can't actually play the drums in a rock band the way they're supposed to be played with one arm. You know, if Steve Clark lost an arm, they would have had to get another guitar player. What, you know, would he have been playing shit with his foot on the guitar? You know,
he'd have had a really low slung pedal steel.
But I said this when I was talking to Greg Runoff. I was like, you know, and then if you look at the way they treated the Rick Allen situation, well, why didn't they treat the Pete Willis situation the same way? Like, let's get this guy some help. He's got a drinking problem, but we're a band. He's in our band. Let's get him some help. No, they just fucking kicked him out. But they keep the one-armed drummer. So that's, well, you know.
I mean, maybe that's one of those things where they've glossed over how much maybe they ever got along with Pete. That's another thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they bands protect fans quite a bit on a personal level. So that just might have been one of those things where they just didn't like the way he was contributing. Maybe either whether he was writing or not, maybe they didn't dig his stuff, or he wasn't writing enough. I don't know. But
if you look at Def Leppard before Pete Willis and after Pete Willis, there's a pretty stark contrast. And in from style, my point of view, I much prefer when Pete Willis was in the band. You can't really quantify exactly how much he had to do with the sound and the songs, but it seems like he had a pretty big amount of input. But yeah, I think the biggest problem Pete Willis had was Mutt Lang didn't like him. And also, Pete Willis has said that it's the best thing that ever happened to him, getting kicked out of the band, because he doesn't think he'd be alive today, which, like I've said already, you know, you look at what happened to Steve Clark and you say, well, maybe so. Yeah.
It's there's a lot of crazy shit that's happened to this band, and it's still going on to this day, you know, with Vivian and everything. So
right. Yeah. So obviously a big part of the delay in the making of this record was what happened to Rick Allen. I mean, obviously that plays a big factor in that. Yeah.
But I'm for one opinion, I'm glad that Rick Allen has proved you wrong. You're entitled to your opinion. But I'm glad that it's, you know, hey man, I'm one of those guys. It's a great story. And, you know, the whole thing about the comeback, it's the underdog thing. And, you know, going to play that Monsters of Rock show, they had a guy ready to play, you know, to back him up.
Yeah.
The guy didn't even make his flight or whatever. And then it turns out they didn't need him at the end of the day. I dig that kind of stuff.
Well, you know? it's a great story, but it's not a great drum sound. That's all I have to say.
Well, in the Classic Albums documentary, Joe Elliott almost made it sound like that this was a happy accident for the band's style, in his opinion, because he almost alluded to the fact that we kept having to tell Rick, you know, don't do those roll downs. It's tired, you know. I mean, everybody does them, and you've been doing them forever. So it almost made it seem like by this happening, it gave them the drum sound they truly wanted. And he didn't say it that way, but in a roundabout way, he implied it, which I thought was kind of interesting. Like, it's kind of dark in a way.
Well, the really ironic thing is Mutt Lang, they already used electronic drums on pretty much all of Pyromania. So the funny thing is they were already doing the electronic drums even before the accident happened, which is really strange. But that's how it worked. They had already done it. My opinion, fuck electronic drums. That's just how I feel about it. But,
well,
in a band like Def Leppard, I mean, in a band like this, a hard rock, heavy metal band, electronic drums, no thanks. That's my point of view.
I think there's certain producers that can pull it off and convince me more than other producers can. And like you just brought up Van Halen, the electronic drum sound in 5150 completely bums me out. But I can deal with most of the Def Leppard stuff, at least on Pyromania and Hysteria. So looks like we are going to fight a little bit, but that's
I love Pyromania, and you know, as a kid, I didn't know the difference between what the drums were back then, you know.
Yeah.
But once you know, it's kind of annoying to hear it sometimes on there. But I love a great drum sound, and you're not going to get that from electronic drums just to my ears. But yeah, I still love Pyromania. It doesn't really hamper my enjoyment of it or anything like that. But
as an A&R rock fan, I'm very curious as to why you might be potentially slagging off Hysteria here. So let's go.
Well, yeah, Hysteria was recorded in Holland, Paris, and Dublin. Finally came out on August 3rd, 1987. Like I said, that was almost 5 years, really, after Pyromania. And it was one of the most expensive records ever made at the time. Phil Collin has been quoted as saying it had to sell 5 million copies just to break even.
Yeah, it was originally 4, but after Steinman, it became 5.
But by the time the last single would be released in early 89, the album had already sold 9 million copies in the U.S. and 15 million worldwide. So they managed to more than break even, obviously, there.
And I think it's 25 worldwide at last count.
Yeah, so. I mean, it's one of the highest selling albums ever. So, yeah, and lots of hit singles. Of course, it was a very slow build, which we'll talk about. But, you know, just for me as a huge fan of Def Leppard's first three albums, basically one of my top five favorite bands of all time. Yeah, I have a lot of problems with this record. And overall, I think I give it a thumbs down. Just my overall opinion of the record as a whole.
Wow, this is going to be a fight.
But yeah, there are songs I love on this album, but as a whole, especially considering the first three records, not my cup of tea, really. So I guess we can start with the first song, Women, which I actually... See, I mean, I wasn't old enough to be into Pyromania when it was brand new, but I remember watching the world premiere on MTV of this video. This was the first single in the US. I think, was Animal the first single in the UK?
Yeah, and I think the rest of the world too. Women was the only was only the single in America first. That was like the first month I actually had MTV. I was really late to the party, and I already knew how to program a VCR. Of course, kids can do it before their parents can.
Yeah.
But I had recorded a Headbangers Ball. Like, I was so excited, my first ball on tape, and Women was on there. So that was the first time I got to see it. It was like, August 87.
Yeah, I mean, this was the return of Def Leppard. So, I mean, by this time, I was 13 when this came out. So by this time, I was a big Def Leppard fan. They were one of my favorite bands. And
me too.
So this was a huge deal that they were back. And to me, the song's kind of baffling to me. The first song on the record, the first single... You know, I talked on Pyromania about how I don't hate the song Rock of Ages, but also it kind of stands out like a sore thumb on that record to me. It's a completely different style. And if you listen to Women, very similar vibe to Rock of Ages to me, except that, like I said, Joe Elliott called Rock of Ages a 3-minute lump of fun. So Women is like Rock of Ages without the fun. that's kind of my takeaway of this song. And it just doesn't work for me. I don't think it's very good. And to have it be the first song on the record and the first single, really, I don't get. That was a really odd choice to me.
Well, to me as an album opener, I really do like the song. I even enjoy it when they play it live. They don't play it at every show, but I actually enjoy it when they play it. As an album opener, and as far as setting the tone for what this kind of record is, I really do think it works. But as a first single, terrible choice. It's long. It's way too long to be a single. It's over 6 minutes, right? At least.
Yeah.
And, you know, even in the days of video, and they didn't even edit the video when it was out, and the video also makes no sense, but it's just a bad choice, you know? So the album Stiffing in America at the beginning, it's not that hard to see why it did initially. So.
It's a far cry from Photograph, right? It's not in the same...
Well, yeah, no, Photograph is a great hard pop song, you know, and like I said, I like the song Women, but it's not a single, you know.
Yeah, I can remember, you know, when I first heard this, I desperately wanted to like it. I'm sure I tried to like it, convinced myself I liked it, but in the end, I don't really like it. But I know, I mean, I'm sure when I was watching that world premiere video, I was trying really hard to like it, because I sure wanted to, you know.
But, yeah, I mean, there was stuff to throw at you. It's kind of like similar to Look It Up, you know, when you see the video for the first time, if you're like, oh, there's stuff to look at that's different now, like Rick Allen and, you know.
Yeah, and Joe Elliott's mullet.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about Rocket, and a song that was when, and it's an original run, like, you know, because this was the first release that I was there for the beginning, much like you said. And at the time, I was like 8 or 9 years old. This was my favorite song on the record, actually, at the time. And lyrically, it's a dumb song, but I can't really hate on a song. Sometimes nowadays I kind of hate reference songs, but nobody was really making a whole lot of songs like these. And especially for a time that's one of my favorite periods of rock and roll, you know, referencing the best of the, you know, early 70s British glam period, if you will. And it's, to me, it kind of says, well, as far as we've gone with the electronics and we realize this, we still love rock and roll, and we still love bands like these, and that's what this song says to me. Maybe I'm over dramatizing it, but that's what Rocket is for me. And a middle section that is definitely their Whole Lot of Love, you know, as far as like, let's throw everything in that. And I don't even think they realize what's on it half the time. But yeah, on that documentary, once again, I'm going to keep referencing that. I never realized what that backwards masking part was at the beginning and in the middle, you know? That's where Fighting for the Gods of War.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think I remember that now.
Yeah.
Joe Elliott said they were inspired to write this song after he heard a 1971 single called Burundi Black. Do you know what? Have you ever heard that?
No, I've never heard the song myself, but I know that story. Yeah.
Yeah. It's by a French guy named Michel Bernholke, but I think he went by, like, Burundi Black was also his name or something when that came out. Yeah, I checked it out, and I guess we'll listen to it right now. Yeah, you're probably not going to like my opinion of Rocket.
The way I talked it up, yeah. But
I think it's terrible. I think pretty much everything about it is bad. There's nothing I like about it. And to me, to think this is the band that made High and Dry, that just makes me sad. Because this doesn't resemble High and Dry in any way, shape, or form to me. And I don't like it at all, personally.
Wow.
Well, moving on to the third song, Animal. Now, I love, really, really, really love this song. I think it's absolutely amazing. There's not really any heavy metal here at all. It's all pop, but I don't have a problem with that. Really, really great song. The bridge is so amazing. And yeah, you know, the verse rides along on the great driving beat, and just all the melodies here are infectious. The chorus great, is killer. To me, it's a masterpiece of a pop single.
Yeah, great bridge. And I'm not being ironic when I say this. I never discount the clap track. Clap track is a big thing for me, and it's perfect. And it still works at every show. Everybody claps to this one. And, yeah, it's pop perfection. It really is. Your favorite song on the album, or are we going to tease another song for later, or is this it?
Probably my favorite. There's two songs that are kind of tied for my favorite, but yeah, this, yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to say for the record, I love On Through the Night, High and Dry, Empire Mania. I really do. I just happen to also love Hysteria, so.
It's not even the same band, so.
I always think of the Bela Lugosi guitar when I hear this song, so. So Phil Collin had great guitars, especially then, you know, always fun to look at, whether it was the glitter guitar or the Bela Lugosi one. So,
and this one was written all the way back in 1984. So I think about, you know, there's kind of a lost Def Leppard album there. There could have been, there totally could have been an album that came out in like 85 that this would have been on. And then the album that came out in 87 would have had shit like Rocket on it, I guess.
Well, possibly, but yeah, there's the two B-sides, if you want to get into the B-sides now or later, I don't know, but two of the B-sides, I think, definitely sound more Pyromania-esque than Hysteria. Like, so, on one hand, I could see why they were cut off the record, almost kind of like what Prince does, you know, it doesn't fit the vibe, you know, because I Want to Be Your Hero and Ring of Fire both sound more like Pyromania songs than Hysteria songs. So for you, if they would have put those two songs on there instead of two other songs, you might like the album a whole lot more.
Yeah, Ring of Fire is crazy brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, there's a quote from Joe Elliott where he says about Ring of Fire, it was just such a vastly different sounding kind of song from the rest of the album. But get this, Ring of Fire sounds the most like Def Leppard of any of the Hysteria era songs. So the one song that sounds the most like Def Leppard is vastly different to the album. I mean, that says something, doesn't it?
It does. But yeah, like I said, that's the reason why it's not on the record, and whether that was his or Mutt's decision or as a whole.
I'm
So there definitely was. There's definitely like a lost Def Leppard album that would have been more of a transitional thing between Pyromania and Hysteria, I think. But you know, just the confluence of events didn't let that happen.
Yeah, like other bands got to do that, they didn't.
Yeah. Well, and I even talked to Julian about how it, you know, since there was also a pretty big leap between High and Dry and Pyromania, and it would have been nice to hear them still pursue the band they were in the High and Dry era for one more record before they made the leap to Pyromania too. I it would have been a really cool career if they had just, you know, not taken such huge leaps between each record.
Yeah, I think they wanted to do it. I think some of the telltales are that constant debate where they talk about how in they were or weren't with the new wave of British heavy metal.
Yeah.
And I think they consciously went more pop for that reason. I think that they just wanted out. Because it really hurt them in that country, honestly. Just knowing that they didn't have a real hit in the UK until Hysteria, that says a lot. Like, that yeah. community, they had their... I'm sure they had their fans, but, you know, they had to get the world first before England. And that never happens. It's always the other way around. But they were bigger in America first, because there was some sort of snobbery about Def Leppard early on that...
Yeah, there was.
Yeah, so...
And they were the new wave of British heavy metal band that leaned much further towards Sweet than UFO. You know, they just went more in the pop, bubblegum type direct. That's what they liked, and that's the kind of songs they wanted to make. I get that. Yeah.
Despite how much Rick looked like Pete Way, they still sounded more like the Sweet. So, but there is a call in there, so...
So moving on to the next song, Love Bites. This was the number one hit off the record and the ballad.
Yeah, the sole number one single, correct?
Yeah, I think, yeah.
I mean, I think that's a combination of it's a ballad, and that's definitely a sign of the times. And the momentum had completely peaked at that point.
Love Bites was number one in October of 88. So that's over a year after the record had come out. Yeah.
BJ, what do you think of Love Bites? Curious.
Well, let me read what I wrote down. No, this is a nightmare. I do not like this at all. It sounds like Babyface produced this shit. This could have been a LaToya Jackson single.
Wow. Not even good enough for Janet, huh?
No.
Oh. Man, wow. I barely know how to respond to that. Okay. It's not, especially lyrically, I've always had a problem with the lyrics. Even at like, you know, 9 years old, 10 years old, I was like, these lyrics are pretty dumb. So if you can't get past lyrics, this is a tough song. There's things I like about the arrangement. You know, I definitely like the solo section better than most things on the song. So... Ooh,
Yeah, I love a good ballad, and so I don't have a problem with ballads. But this song, well, for one, the production on this song is horrendous, in my opinion, and it just doesn't have a good melody. And yeah. So the combination of really bad production and a pretty bland melody just makes for, you know, and especially coming from Def Leppard, it makes for ugh. And then it's a number one hit, so there you go.
Yeah, well, it crossed over. But it broke the Lemmy rule, because Joe Elliott said this is his parents' favorite song. So Lemmy always said, if your parents don't like it, it's good. That's always a sign of great rock and roll.
So I do like the ooh, babe, oh, babe part. You know, moving on to song number five. I mean, we were talking about Ring of Fire. Well, Ring of Fire was going to be on the record until this song took its place, basically, is the story they give. And, you know, Joe just made this shit up in the studio at the last minute. It's the last thing that was written and recorded.
Yeah, and they're already like, this album's way too long already, yeah. You know. And you want us to do another song. Like, that was the whole attitude going in, right?
Yeah, but then the song might have saved their whole career. I mean, really, so... But
yeah, absolutely, no doubt about that.
Yeah,
no doubt.
I wrote down
the biggest song of all time.
Yeah, of course we're talking about Pour Some Sugar on Me, which I wrote down. This song's like Gerardo's follow up to Rico Suave.
What, we want the funk?
Oh yeah, he did have a follow up, didn't he?
Yeah.
Pour Some Sugar on Me, I guess it's catchy, but it just depresses me that this is the same band that made High and Dry that's putting this out. It's, yeah, you know.
Is there anything in you that likes the song? I mean, you can't live like that, BJ, not as a fan. I feel like that's kind of the wrong attitude. You know, like, you can still love those old records, but you can't also love Pour Some Sugar on Me?
I would prefer to never hear it again in my entire life.
I'm not gonna say it's not overplayed, you know, but it's one of those things. It's, to me, it is kind of like a Rock and Roll All Night. It's not as great as that song. I'm not saying that. Like, if it's on the radio, you know, I'll probably skip it. But, you know, when I hear it live, I have fun. I think it's an infectious room thing. Everybody's having fun, so I want to have fun too. And you know, it's not too much of a force.
It is fun. Like I said, you know, Joe Elliott said Rock of Ages was a 3-minute lump of fun, but and women, there's just no fun in that. This is fun. It's a fun song. Yeah. But it's also incredibly stupid.
Well, of course. Yeah, I mean, I still, you know, like a lot of people, I re-listened to the album again. I listened to the album pretty consistently anyway, but I listened to it again last night. I had a first generation copy of this. I never actually owned it until later on CD, so I didn't have the luxury of the lyrics. And I swear, this is probably some of the most misinterpreted lyrics, like, of all time for me. Like, I still don't know all the words to Pour Some Sugar on Me, and I've heard this song a million trillion fucking times. I may reference Reservoir Dogs, but yeah, that makes me think of that I still don't know all the words of this album as much as I love the album.
Did you hear the commercial we did on Battle of the Podcast All-Stars, the Def Leppard radar phones?
And now here's a word from our sponsor.
Are you suffering from hearing loss? When people are talking to you, does everyone sound like this? Then you should try the new Def Leppard radar phone with hearing enhancements. With Def Leppard radar phones, you'll be living like a lover in no time. And we're not fooling.
The whole story about the dictaphones, do you have any more info on that? Because that's what they always talk about with this song, that they were using dictaphones throughout the studio to communicate.
No, I don't know.
Yeah, because that's where the best line of the whole song comes from. It's something that Mutt said that was garbled, and Joe interpreted it as Love Is Like a Bomb, Baby Come On, Get It On.
Oh, okay. To me,
you know, it's once again a dumb lyric, but I think that sets the pace. You know, it's got good attitude, and that's the only thing I've ever been able to understand almost in the whole song ever. And it's the only part that makes sense to me, at least.
Yeah, I'm sure if I hadn't heard the song 7 billion times, I could enjoy it.
I gotta say, like, you know, between the label, but Wayne Isham probably deserves a lot of credit for this song taking off. Because not that the song wouldn't have done well on radio, but of course video was the thing at the time. And I know that sounds obvious saying that to guys like us, you know, but maybe there's somebody younger listening to this. I'd like to think so. But
maybe.
Yeah, well, what Wayne Isham did for this band, I mean, really, the guy definitely, I'm assuming hopefully he got a platinum award for this. But, you know, they were in, you know, forgive me, I don't know the name of the town. It could have been any town, Idaho or whatever. And they're doing a gig and Wayne's hired to do the video. You know, they're on the road. It's like, let's make the road video. Everybody does it. I made Home Sweet Home. Let's make the next Home Sweet Home. That's always the goal, right? So I think what happened was, from what they say, and I read this in the a really cool oral history book about MTV, is that Wayne basically went into town, you know, like at the local mall or what have you, and found the 20 best looking girls in town and gave them all front row passes, you know, and access and all that stuff. And those are like the same 20 girls throughout that video, you know, making the most lust-filled faces at that band. Yeah. That girl that halfway sticks her tongue out, just like half the top comes off in the Home Sweet Home video.
Yeah.
That look right there probably sold an easy million for that record. It's the Elvis paradigm. You know the Elvis paradigm. That video did the most for that band than anything ever in the history of the band, I think, as far as success and money goes. And don't discount the video as a selling tool. And that's a prime example of how one video can turn an entire album around. And you watch the original video, and you're like, well, that's not going to happen.
I just remember Joe Elliott's jeans that were so cut up, they were practically mesh, you know?
Yeah.
Like the stonewashed jeans that were just, I don't know, somebody spent a lot of time cutting those jeans up.
They get bored on the road, you know, right? Especially at that time, there's no internet.
Yeah, well, I mean, MTV was responsible for the majority of Pyromania's sales, too, probably. So, yeah, I mean, MTV was very kind to Def Leppard.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, moving on to the next song, Armageddon It. This is a really good song. I like the melody a lot, and the wordplay on the chorus is clever. But I wrote down, it sounds like a good Roxette song.
Wow.
And, you know, there are good Roxette songs. I'll admit that.
Yeah, I mean, they had hits. You can't say they didn't. Yeah, I mean, it's to me, it's almost just a straight sequel, you know, and that's because of where it falls, because it definitely was a follow-up single. I don't know exactly after or just after Pour Some Sugar on Me. They made the same video, so they do kind of run together for me, honestly. But I think there's some really good riffage in there. And, of course, once again, bringing up the genius of Steve Clark. Steve Clark, my favorite rhythm guitar player of all time after Malcolm Young. You know, he just had the touch, you know, if I...
Definitely.
If I may. Yeah, and it just... He was... And, you know, as much as I am a fan of even, you know, post-Pyromania, Def Leppard, like I'm outing myself here. There's no outing. I've always been this way. But I do definitely agree that Steve Clark was the heart and soul of Def Leppard. And even on an album that's as overproduced as Hysteria is, you can hear his contributions and you know when he's playing and you know when that's his riff.
And I'm pretty sure Armageddon, it was one of the earlier written songs, like 84, 85. Went to number 3 in the U.S., so it was one of the bigger hits, actually.
Still going to hear it at every show, too. So.
You got it. But are you-
Maybe so, I should have saved Steve for Gods of War, because that's his song for sure.
Yeah, that is a lot of Steve Clark riffs. So I guess that's the first song on side two, right?
Yes. I'm
flipping it over for Gods of War. Now,
Man. And another, it's weird, they kicked off both sides with, like, long songs. You could say epic. That doesn't always mean good, in your case with women. But I would think that you would like Gods of War. Am I wrong about this?
I like Gods of War, but it's so long and repetitive that during the song it already gets old for me. You know, it's like halfway through the song you want it to be over. That's how I feel about it. It's good, but it's not great, and it's just too long and repetitive. It's kind of like a lullaby. At some point you're going to fall asleep.
There are, you know, when it gets into that movie mode, I do tend to cash out a little bit on it for sure. But for me, there's enough in there to enjoy. Once again, I love that opening riff. Even just the way it starts, simple drum and bass thing. When that riff kicks in, I get a chill every single time. They actually had this in their set list during the Rock of Ages tour a few years ago. And they busted it out. And not that it went over that great with the crowd, but I really enjoyed it. So, yeah. People were going to the bathroom about halfway through. I get it. You know, whatever.
I think it's, especially for, like, more hardcore Def Leppard fans, it's one of the favorites on the album. But I think on a better album, it wouldn't really stand out as much. I think here it's one of the better songs, but it just seems better than it is because it's of what it's surrounded by.
I think this and maybe one other song on the second side here, or the B-side, is the most Pyromania-esque, for sure.
And why Reagan? That's just what I would like to ask. You know, I don't want to hear that. So
everybody had Reagan, man. Yeah. Everybody had Reagan. So I always think of Two Tribes when I think of a Reagan sample. Even though that's not even a sample, that's a voice actor. Which is actually so in Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Two Tribes, that's actually Chris Berry from Red Dwarf. So okay. Felt the need to reference one of my favorite shows ever.
So moving on to the next song, Don't Shoot Shotgun, which I wrote down, it's reasonably enjoyable, but also really dumb. Not terrible, but who cares? That's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I like the music, but the lyrics are overly dumb. I mean, the title is bad going in, so you almost kind of know what you're getting before you even hear the song. Like even back when I first listened to the album, I saw that song title and I was like, even at that young age. And, you know, if I had to get a song rewritten lyrically and be completely aloof to the fact that it was rewritten, I would hope that it would be this song. I would have probably put Tear It Down on there instead.
For sure.
If you're going to go for a song like that, Tear It Down replaces Don't Shoot Shotgun. If I have to say there is a piece of filler on this album, it's that song. It's Don't Shoot Shotgun.
I couldn't agree more. That's perfectly said. Tear It Down, replace Don't Shoot Shotgun. I agree wholeheartedly.
It's, you know, the same kind of approach musically and everything. Yeah. So that to me should have been the thing.
I think though that Tear It Down was written even after Pour Some Sugar on Me. if I'm right about that, so that it, they might have had it too late to even put on the record. I think maybe. But, you know, they put on the B-side of Women, and I've always loved that song. It's really great.
Did you watch the VMAs the night they played, and they just played that?
Yeah.
We were like, what is
yeah, that was
what?
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
You know, and then years later, they ended up putting it on Adrenalize, so...
Yeah. It's slightly different on Adrenalize. I mean, they replayed it.
For yeah, I would have just always listened to the original version over that.
But what do you think... I was going to ask you. I have my theory on this, but... Do you think Ride Into the Sun ever had a chance on that record?
I doubt it. They did pretty much completely rewrite the song. You know, it's very, very different. The B-side, the Hysteria era B-side from what was on their first EP.
Yeah.
It's like a totally different chorus. The melody, they made it, the melody's better. I like it. I like the rewritten version more.
Yeah, oh yeah, I actually do too, and I'm not just saying that, but... I have a theory that the only reason, and they probably just were playing it, or that's like, you know, maybe Joe had rewritten it, maybe you see like, hey, let's see if this has a shot, but I don't think it was ever intended to be on Hysteria, but I think one of the reasons they did at least cut it was as, you know, maybe for Rick Allen, because this could have been one of the first things, you know, with the one arm, with the new kit, it's a song he knows already. And maybe it was just like the familiarity and let's, you know, it feels, you know, like back at home kind of thing. And that's one of my theories on why they even approached this song at all, because I don't think it would have made the record stylistically, but I think it was just a nice thing for them to do for Rick, maybe. Just a thought.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just funny that all those B-sides sound a lot more like Def Leppard than almost anything that's on the actual record.
So. Yeah. Well, they also didn't go through the Mutt Ringer, you know, as much, you know, because if they were going to go on the record, they definitely would have put a lot more guitar tracks on there, layer it more vocal layer, the whole thing.
True. Good point. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So Don't Shoot Shotgun. It's like I said on the Pyromania episode, you know, Action Not Words is kind of the song on there that stands out as like too easy. Like they could probably write that in 5 minutes. And I think Don't Shoot Shotgun is the same.
You know, Run Riot's a good handshake from Pyromania to Hysteria, I think. I like Run Riot, actually.
Yeah, I like it. I really don't like the drum sound. The drum sound is what stands out to me as a problem, but...
That's the only thing that makes it sound like it's not on Pyromania. You know, it'd be more, a little more organic, and it would easily have a heavier feel to it. It's a fun song. Could have easily been a hit. You know, it's on an album full of hits. That's one of those songs, and I'll reference another one of those later, but I'll also shout out to my friend Logan, who constantly co-hosts on my show, that this is his favorite song on Hysteria.
It's good, but I definitely think it could have been there could have been a better arrangement and better production that could have made it really great, probably.
Yeah.
But they kind of fucked it up, I think, a little bit here. Probably Mutt more than anything. But I think High and Dry was pretty much perfectly produced, from my opinion. And then, I don't know, Mutt just... I said Mutt Lang morphed into an eccentric genius with the emphasis on the first word.
For the record, I do think he's a genius producer.
Moving on to the title track, which, you know, this is the one with Animal for me. For me, I like Animal and Hysteria 100 times more than anything else on here. Really, really love both songs. Hysteria, I absolutely love.
I'm so glad you said that. We can still be friends, BJ.
Oh, that's great.
I love this song. I think it's a perfect song. I don't think it's too mushy. I think it's just no. on the, you know, it could be, if they'd have gone a little further with it, it potentially could have been, but this is a perfect song. I still get chills. Yeah, I'm kissing this album's ass a lot, but, you know, I always love hearing it live. Nothing wrong with this song at all. And apparently what did they say? I was watching the Historia video collection or whatever it was. The highest tested video in MTV history up until that point. Like, it took 5 seconds for them to give it a, you know, A-OK. Just everything is great about this song.
Yeah, really, really skillful songwriting. And I think it's really inspired and the emotion comes through, which to me, there's not a ton of emotion on this record. It's kind of like...
True.
But I think, yeah, this song, you know, the emotion of it feels honest. And as far as songwriting... You know, this song should be used in a class on songwriting for sure, because this is great songwriting. And it's interesting that, from what I've heard them say, they like had the whole song, but they didn't have a title. And when Rick Allen came up with Hysteria for the album title, they plugged that into the chorus of this song, and it worked. I think that's how it went.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, that title doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the context of what the rest of the song is.
Yeah.
You know, it gives way to... that fun little play with words, the magical Mysteria, obviously a Beatles callback. And callback, they actually admitted. Did you ever see the Storytellers they did for VH1, like, forever ago?
Probably.
It was back when Euphoria came out.
Yeah, I definitely saw it, yeah.
And at the end of it, at the very end part, you know, with the little mini solo there at the end, and Joe Elliott sings Heroes over it, and it fits perfectly. So, even admitting that they ripped off Heroes. But, yeah, there you go. But it's subtle, isn't it? I mean, most people may not have even realized that until you say it. But it's there.
And I guess it was based on a Rick Savage riff. Like, that was the origin of the song. And this one was written back in 85, too. Can't stop. You can look at the songs that were from more of the 84-85 era as opposed to the later songs, and I think you can see the two different albums that would have been.
There is a more BJ friendly album in an alternate universe.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Moving on to the next song, Excitable. What I had to say about this song is it's a Robert Palmer song. Like, simply irresistible, addicted to love, excitable.
Sure. He should have done this song.
And that's not a good thing.
So. You don't like Robert Palmer?
No. I don't.
I actually like a decent amount of his stuff, but
well, yeah. I don't know what I've even heard besides those hit songs.
I'm talking about earlier stuff, Power yeah. Station stuff, you know.
Well, yeah. I don't really like that either, but
yeah. He's got if you dig a little deep on him, he's pretty fun, you know. He's kind of a poppier Brian Ferry, obviously. Same approach, guys in suits.
Yeah.
Excitable. Once again, I think it's just slightly better than Don't Shoot Shotgun. How about that?
No, I like Don't Shoot Shotgun more.
Really?
Yeah. The bottom songs on this would be Rocket, Excitable, Love Bites. That would be like the bottom for me here.
Even the Alien Sex intro doesn't do anything for you, huh? Whatever that is.
That this song is just dumb and just it's like Simply Irresistible or something. That's what it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did enjoy this song as a kid, but it hasn't aged well.
Yeah, exactly. More than anything, it has not aged well. That's yeah. Yeah. And then they end the record with Love and Affection, which is a good pop song, but it is so cheesy.
It is, but man, can you imagine what other bands thought about this song in a sense like, come on, guys, you already have like 7 fucking singles off this, and you don't even release this one as a single, and this is a home run for any band at this time.
Yeah, yeah.
That had to drive them nuts. Like, you know, and I still like this song. I do actually like the hook in the chorus, much like they even say in the lyrics, there's not a whole lot of rhyme or reason to it, and it's a very simple lyric. There's nothing groundbreaking about it, and it is hysteria too, even not even waiting for the next album to kind of retread. It's Hysteria Part 2, not as good, you know, but I do really enjoy that melody. I really do.
I like it too, but if I could listen to Hysteria twice in a row or listen to Hysteria in this, I would just listen to Hysteria twice in a row. Yeah. You know, kind of where I'm at with it. This song would have been like, if they could have shopped this song to other artists. Like, I was trying to think of who else could have done this and had a hit with it, and I was thinking like Cher. You know, like it could have been Cher's follow up to If I Found Someone or somebody like that.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
It would have been a good pop single for a different artist, I think. We'll be right back.
Was there a longer single platter at the time?
It's definitely one of the longest single album record vinyl records ever. It has 63 minutes.
Yeah, I still remember that hype sticker on the vinyl. 12 songs, 63 minutes.
Yeah.
And they had to make the cassettes longer too. They weren't making cassettes that long for, you know, actual studio albums at the time. So even like, you know, I think Digilog debuted on this cassette as well.
Oh, really? Mistaken. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was the first cassette to use it as far as I remember, but I remember seeing the label first on Hysteria.
Final verdict on Hysteria. I already said it's got those two amazing songs that I absolutely love. So, but as a cohesive album, it's not something I really like overall.
I love the record, but yeah, and my only nitpicks are, you know, I'm not a fan of George Lucasing an album at this point, but Tear It Down should have been on the record for sure. Yeah, there's other things like, have you seen Viva Hysteria? Are you into seeing something like that?
No, I haven't.
They actually pulled, you know, it's one of those things where like, are they going to pull it off live? And even like the live accounts of people saying there's not a whole lot of sweetening on the album, they actually do pull it off live. And it does sound a lot like they're using tracks on stage, but they swear they don't. I'm always looking for it because I'm a nerd about those things, and I can't really see it. I know Rick probably has drum triggers for sure for some things. I mean, that's pretty obvious. Even Tommy Lee has drum triggers probably for the whole set, right? But no, I mean, if you're a fan of this album, go check out Viva Hysteria. The Blu-ray CD thing is really cool. And BJ, if you're a fan, like the fan that you are, the High and Dry, On Through the Night, some Pyromania.
I love Pyromania, yeah.
They do two sets on the Blu-ray where they opened up for themselves, where they were like not themselves. They called themselves Dead Flatbird. And they like dug really deep and played like really cool fan favorites.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so go check out that Viva Hysteria, even just for this, get the Blu-ray special edition. Has the two Dead Flatbird opening sets on there. They're awesome. So there's my fanboy recommendation for further listening. You know what I think of Hysteria. I think it's close to 5 stars. Not perfect, but it's a damn great record, and I still love it. Still listen to it all the time.
Well, you said you don't like George Lucasing the records, but I love doing that. And I love imagining, you know, I think there was a record that would have had Animal, Hysteria, Ring of Fire, Fractured Love. There was a record there.
Yeah.
That would have been amazing. That could have been really great. Well, that would have come out in like 85.
Yeah. Well, that's more alternate universe than George Lucasing.
Yeah. Yeah, and then what? So then you would have had that record, which would have been much more of a hard rock record, and then the next record would have been the one with Rocket, Love Bites, Pour Some Sugar on Me, you know, all of that stuff. Well, I guess Love and Affection would have been on the 85 record, too. You could have almost put the whole record together. It worked out the way it worked out, and obviously it worked out for them, since it's one of the biggest selling albums of all time.
Yeah, it's definitely a more interesting story, you know, the whole weight and everything. So I'm not saying your scenario isn't cool, because I do like the idea of it.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Joey, for talking to me about Hysteria.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And it was really good to have somebody who I knew was a big fan of the record on.
But it would have been boring if we'd have both kissed his ass, you know. So,
but we both agree that there are two songs on this record that, you know, wow.
Yeah. 5 stars.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. And we'll do it again sometime. We'll definitely do No Shame in the future. And
That'd be great. And listen, subscribe, and share Rock Strikes 10, all that good stuff. So check out my show if you enjoyed me enough on this episode or any of the other ones. Yeah.
title track from the new album.
We'll be right back. Okay, let's go. Let's go.
Off we go, Joe.
Last one, then you can go out.
Boring Holland.
Well, the mountains of Holland, as Joe would say.
One of the many things that gets me about this is, how did you know you'd finished this album after all this time? What was the point where you said, that's it?
Somebody told me. I knew because I was the last person in, and I sung the very last word that went down. So that was it. I knew it was finished. I couldn't believe it.
Self-indulgent, sorry.
It was unbelievable. I wasn't happy. I wasn't ecstatic. I wasn't leaping up and down. It was just like a big... it was one of them, you know, like a massive sigh of relief. But, I mean, you know, we had our ups and downs, but it's finished now, and we're definitely on an up now.
How many times did you actually record the album and reject it?
It was sort of... This is like the third attempt, but it was really only one and a half, I suppose. We did some tracks, not the whole album. We did some tracks with Jim Steinman that were useless, so I scrapped them. And then we started again with Nigel Green, who was Mutt's engineer. And we scrapped a lot of that, but we did keep some of it. And then Mutt moved in on the project about halfway through what we were doing with Nige. And... salvaged some stuff and we started some stuff again, but we hadn't started it all by the time Mutt came in. We'd maybe been six songs deep, so we had six songs started from scratch anyway. So it's kind of three attempts, but really only one and a half, if you get me drift.
Was Pyromania one of the many problems, but that was always in the back of your mind, that you've always got to do better than that?
Well, It appears that way, but what it is really, we just wanted to improve on it no matter how good it had been. I mean, if Pyromania had been twice as good as it was, it would have been even harder, because we just want to keep getting better. We didn't want to just accept that was the peak of our capabilities, so let's just emulate the thing. We wanted to go out there and better it 100% like we did, we bettered High and Dry with Pyromania. So in that sense, yes, but only in like an, it was like a, just an ambition within the band to actually just keep getting better. Pyromania was a certain standard, so obviously that was the blueprint and the problem at the same time.
Standard of songs are we talking about here that you wanted to exceed?
Standard of everything. Performance, production, songwriting, feel, vibe, you name it. Attitude, sleeve design, everything. We just wanted everything to be a lot better than Pyromania. We could have copied Pyromania in 3 weeks. We could have done an album. If you check out the B-side, the single Tear It Down, we did that in 2 days. Sung, recorded, mixed, wrote, everything in 2 days. We could have thrown an album out in maybe 5-6 weeks that would have been to the standard of that.
Yeah, but how far would it have got? No. That's how we looked at it.
Tear It Down, we did specifically that way, just to see how it'd sound. And I'm, you know, obviously it doesn't sound as... it doesn't sound as good, I suppose, as the A-side. It's not supposed to. It's a totally different way of recording. But it still sounds all right. You could play it back-to-back to most rock albums, and it's still better than them. But it's not what we wanted to do for the album. You know, maybe next time we will. Who knows, you know. We wanted to take the Pyromania type of recording to the furthest we could take it. And I think we've just about done that with this record.
now to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with the first thing that Def Leppard recorded after Hysteria when they started working on the follow-up to Hysteria. This was recorded in Holland with Mike Shipley on May 5th of 1988, and Steve Clark is on this version of the song. This song would eventually end up on Adrenalize, but this is the original version, recorded in 1988. It's a song called Tonight. Till next time.
I'll be back.